So good afternoon. Welcome to the 492nd meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. The forum has been meeting monthly since 1983 to hear from an invited speaker on a topic central to U.S. foreign policy. Today, we are pleased to have Mr. George Chalos speaking on Anchoring Power, the Rise of the U.S. as Global Enforcers of the Maritime Industry. George M. Chalos is the principal and founding member of Chalos & Company, P.C. Mr. Chalos has been engaged in the practice of international maritime, admiralty, and regulatory law for nearly 30 years. He is experienced in all facets of complex civil, criminal, and administrative cases, sanctions, maritime attachment and vessels arrests, a MARPOL, which stands for Maritime Pollution, and it's a treaty on this subject, and environmental matters, and other international maritime and commercial transactions. He is a seasoned and respected litigator, having been counsel of record in over 2,000 civil and criminal maritime matters in over 20 different U.S. district and appellate courts. Mr. Chalos has earned the high distinction of being recognized as a Proctor of the Admiralty by fellow members of the Maritime Law Association of the United States. He is a contributing member and author for the ShipArrest.com network, an international network of lawyers who specialize in handling ship arrests and attachments around the world. Mr. Chalos is admitted to practice in the Supreme Court of the United States, the United States Court of Appeals for the 1st, 2nd, 4th, 5th, 9th, 11th, and District of Columbia Circuit Courts, and in numerous U.S. federal district courts and appellate courts. He has authored numerous articles on the matter of legal significance in law journals and bar association newsletters, and he is regularly called upon as a speaker at conferences throughout the world. George, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Thank you, George, for that wonderful introduction, and thank you to Sandy and Patricia for inviting me. My name is George, and I'm a maritime lawyer. I'm a New York guy with an office in New York and Houston. Don't hold either against me. And it's true, I came from Salt Lake City yesterday. My bride and my dog live out there. Don't ask me why, but I married a Texas girl who has no interest in living in New York. So I'm on the road more than I'm home, and apparently that's just the way she likes it. It's been some time since I've been in the Elks Club. I've been many times. The last time it was for a bachelor party, and I'll tell you, the crowd looked a little different. But today we're here to talk about the rise of the United States as global enforcers in the maritime industry. In order to talk about that, it's like sports, right? You wouldn't wear your ice skates on the basketball court. You got to know the field you're playing on, and you got to know the rules of the game. So let's talk a little bit about maritime law. The founding fathers of the United States all agreed that the federal courts, not local courts or state courts, would exercise exclusive jurisdiction over admiralty matters because maritime matters often involve questions of national importance. And in fact, Article 3 of the Constitution says that judicial power shall extend to all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction. So as a new country 250 some odd years ago, where are we going to get the precedent from? How do we know what to do? So we look to English law, and they have hundreds of years of maritime law. And so we borrowed it as much as we like to borrow at that point in time. And apparently, as my sisters remind me, the practice continues with American girls stealing the prince. But the early cases of maritime jurisdiction involved things like seizures of ships for commercial claims, piracy, government seizures to enforce revenue laws, but also seizures of vessels violating the congressional ban on American ships participating in the international slave trade. Sounds an awful lot like the sanctions we're talking about, isn't it? But as a proud Greek, it wasn't the Brits, it wasn't the Americans, it was the Greeks that started the examples of economic sanctions as a foreign policy tool, going back all the way to 432 BC with the Megarian Decree. And Pericles, of course, decided that they were going to prohibit the Megarian citizens from the harbors and marketplaces throughout the Athenian Empire. But what about here in the U.S.? Well, we know, when we look back through the case law and look back through the history, that if we go back to the War of 1812, the Secretary of the Treasury administered sanctions against Great Britain, the people we stole the law from, for the harassment of American sailors. And then during the Civil War, Congress approved the law which prohibited transactions with the Confederacy and called for the forfeiture of goods involved in such transactions, and also had a licensing regime under which rules and regulations administered by the Treasury were applied. Sounds an awful lot like Trafigura and Vitol buying Venezuelan oil, doesn't it? But the Treasury Department was only established in 1789, and their goal was to promote economic prosperity and ensuring the soundness and security of the U.S. and the international financial systems. The Treasury Department also seeks to play a role in the safeguard of U.S. financial systems by, and I'll quote from their mission, implementing economic sanctions against foreign threats to the U.S. and identifying and targeting the financial support networks of national security threats. Within the Department of Treasury, there's an agency or sub-agency called the Office of Foreign Assets Control. And this was created in December of 1950 following the entry of China into the Korean War. President Truman declared a national emergency and blocked all Chinese and North Korean assets that were subject to U.S. jurisdiction. And OFAC, as any good government agency, also has a mission statement. And its mission statement is to administer and enforce economic and trade sanctions based on U.S. foreign policy and national security goals against targeted foreign countries and regimes, terrorists, international narcotics traffickers, those engaged in activities related to the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, and other threats to the national security, foreign policy, or economy of the United States. Does it get any broader than that? But here today, we're going to talk about the rise of the U.S. and its enforcement in the maritime sector. Now here, we can go up and down the main coast and we see a tremendous amount of boats, right? Some pleasure, some working boats. But what we don't see is a huge number of commercial vessels, not international blue water vessels. So how does the U.S., without an identifiable U.S. flag fleet, do it? Well, just take a deep breath and think about it. Money, the dollar. In international trade and transport, the U.S. dollar is the lingua franca of international business. And there's plenty of cases that talk about things like it is the common practice of foreign entities who engage in international maritime transactions to make and receive payments in U.S. dollar transfers. Why? Because we have a stable banking system. But does that mean no one else does? What about the dirham or the Sing? I can tell you when Greece almost left the Eurozone, we had numerous clients that set up Plan Bs, and that was either in Dubai or in Singapore, and they were ready to switch with a couple clicks of the mouse from U.S. dollars or euros over to the Sing or dirhams. But not just money, what about insurance? We know some of the largest ocean marine insurers are here in the U.S., AIG, Travelers, Chubb. The German company, Allianz, has got a huge presence in the U.S., as does Berkshire Hathaway. But in the blue water international shipping space, there's a consortium of insurers. They're mutual clubs called P&I, or Protection and Indemnity Clubs. And all of them, Schooled, Guard, North Standard, Britannia, U.K., West of England, they all have offices. Most of them in New York, some are in New York and Houston, some are in other places like New Jersey or Florida. And of course, the American P&I Club, as the name would suggest, headquartered in New York, but of course, offices also around the globe, just like the other clubs. But what about oil majors? ConocoPhillips, Valero, Marathon, Chevron, Phillips 66, ExxonMobil. Aren't they all in Houston or San Antonio or some combination thereof? Don't they have offices in other places around the states and they're headquartered with international subsidiaries, all coming back to the U.S.-based mothership? But what about the non-U.S. oil majors? BP, remember the Deepwater Horizon in the U.S. Gulf? BP stands for British Petroleum, but they've got a giant campus right on I-10 on the way out to Katy, Texas, where my home is. Saudi Aramco, building 100,000 some odd square foot plant down there now. Total, Shell, PetroChina, they're all here, and they all use U.S. dollars. And what about those ships? Where are they registered? The law of the flag says each ship has to have a nationality. The number one ship registry in the world is Liberia. 80 Broad Street, Monrovia, Liberia. It's got to be the biggest office building on the planet. There's thousands of companies there. But Liberia has over 260 million gross tons and approximately 5,100 ships. They've taken over recently for Panama. That was the number one flag registry for many years. But where is the Liberian registry headquartered? That's not at 80 Broad Street, Monrovia, Liberia. It's on Indian Creek Drive in Dulles, Virginia. After Panama, what comes next? The Marshall Islands. Marshall Islands have 200 million gross tons and approximately 5,400 ships. Where's the Marshall Islands registry based? Well, it's not on the atoll, I'll tell you that. It's in Reston, Virginia. So now you can see the connection, how the U.S. has become a prime enforcer in the maritime world. And of course, we have federal district judges that recognize New York, particularly, as a home to one of the largest ports in the world. Probably not accurate, but that's what Judge Clark said down in Beaumont. But he went on to say, its courts are well-versed in admiralty matters, so its decisions are persuasive. That may be more accurate because of forum selection clauses that put maritime disputes in the Southern District of New York. But what about our ports? It's not really New York. There's not a lot going on in New York, but the port's actually called the Port of New York in New Jersey. Go to Newark. If you've flown into the airport, you'll see thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of containers right there. You go a little further down towards Philly, you'll see all the refineries and all the tankers coming up the Delaware River. But it's not just in the Northeast. In the Gulf, Houston's probably the biggest port, both in volume and space, not to be outdone by other places in the Gulf like Beaumont and Port Arthur, New Orleans. But what about when we go out to the West Coast, the Port of LA and Long Beach? Super gigantic, not gigantic, super gigantic. And by the way, if that's not enough, how many folks in the room enjoy going on a cruise ship? Port of Miami, right? And you get on your ship, does it ever say Miami home port on the back? No, of course not. Monrovia, Liberia, Panama, right? But with all that as the backdrop, I asked the question slightly rhetorically, but is it a bridge too far? Is it too much for the U.S. to exercise regulatory and enforcement jurisdiction on a worldwide basis? What makes us the policemen of the world? Now, I spent six figures on law school, and I learned about things like comity and rules against extraterritoriality. But 30 years in, I said, why did I learn that stuff if we're doing all this? But I'd like to share with you a little video clip. And this comes under the heading of the U.S. enforcement of MARPOL violations. As George described earlier, MARPOL is an acronym. It's an international treaty, more than 50 years old. The actual name is MARPOL 7378, which indicates the year that it was first enacted and then subsequently amended. So let's listen, if we can, in just a moment here, about what the Department of Justice says when they're talking about enforcing MARPL.
I think what this shows is that it's a small world out there. If you're dumping on the high seas, if you're dumping in another country's waters, there are ways for us to find out. At the same time, we're prosecuting only the tip of the iceberg, only the tip. The problem is greater than we know, and we know it's a great big problem.
Let me stop for a second. I'd like to play it again, and I'd like you to focus on two statements that a very senior official from the Department of Justice transmits in his video. If you're dumping on the high seas, okay, maybe I'll bite on that, maybe. If you're dumping in another country's waters, what the hell are we talking about? We don't want to send our guys off to Iran to fight, do we? Would we ever prosecute an Italian guy that robs a bank in Rome in New York? No chance. But listen again to the...
I think what this shows is that it's a small world out there. If you're dumping on the high seas, if you're dumping in another country's waters, there are ways for us to find out. At the same time, we're prosecuting only the tip of the iceberg, only the tip. The problem is greater than we know, and we know it's a great big problem.
So what's the hook, right? The Department of Justice lawyers are super capable and they're super well-trained. So what's the hook? Well, Commander Dewey told us back in 2018 in one of the Coast Guard publications that the thought process behind the prosecutions of these high seas violations was similar to what we've seen in other areas of the law. And he wrote, just as the murdering crime boss Al Capone was imprisoned for tax evasion, these foreign-flagged high seas polluters may be prosecuted by the port state, not for the pollution that occurred beyond the port state jurisdiction, but for the false oil record book presented within the port state jurisdiction. It's a record-keeping violation, and that's how they get you. If you come into the U.S. and you don't have an accurate oil record book, which is supposed to contemporaneously memorialize all the movements of oil and oily waste, if it's knowingly false, it's a crime. Now, it's not just a crime. It's a number of crimes. It's obstruction of an agency proceeding. It's a false statement. It's the crime under the Act to Prevent Pollution from Ships. And by the way, cooking the books, you'll remember the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. For the individuals, that's a 20-year statute for incarceration. Pretty heavy-duty stuff. Now, what about in the sanctions realm? Pretty serious stuff for high seas polluters, but what about these same shipping companies and same vessels and their crew that's now carrying contraband cargo? Well, the Office of Foreign Asset Control says, look, Coast Guard, it's not just you guys, we're in on the act too. And they interpret executive orders and statutes, and they maintain a list of individuals, companies, and vessels owned or controlled by or acting for on behalf of sanctions targets. And how do they get them? They get them by blocking their property, predominantly US dollars. Any money being sent from one place to anywhere else in the world, whether you're the sender or the receiver, if it's a US dollar transaction, it has to pass through an intermediary bank, primarily located in New York. And the OFAC filter is a way that they monitor these transactions, and if there's a transaction that's either sent by or intended to go to a designated entity or person, it gets stopped and frozen and held. Very powerful stuff. Now, who's subject to these sanctions? Well, organizations formed in the U.S., U.S. citizens, permanent residents, and all persons covered wherever located and foreign nationals located in the United States. Wait a minute. We're not talking about people now, we're talking about money. Yep, it's in the United States when it's coming through that filter. That's the hook on these types of restraints. And now, this is powerful. If we go back to the theory of follow the money, if you are designated to the Special Designated National List, or the SDN, in government circles and in private practice, it's commonly referred to as a civil death. And you see the Miami Herald I put on the screen a screen grab from one of their online publications that says, how U.S. sanctions turn people into economic pariahs and why some call it a civil death. Because you can't do business. That's why. And the government, our government's been quite serious about trying to find out how the networks, predominantly in the crude oil and other petroleum product trade, is funding terror, funding the Iranian regime, funding Hezbollah. And you'll see here on the screen, I have a screen grab from one of the maritime publications showing the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, offering $15 million reward for information on the Iranian oil schemes. Unprecedented, as the article went on to describe. Why is so interested in that? Because it's big money. Because it is funding a tremendous amount of what we're now fighting about. And this article goes back to 2019. That's before COVID. Does anybody remember those times? But the U.S. government, in the early days of these sort of enforcement efforts, it was civil, commercial, arm-twisting. Wasn't actually going to court and winning cases. No company wanted to get designated. No individual wanted to get designated. So there were a number of ships that were believed to have been carrying, whether knowingly or unknowingly, this contraband cargo. And so those ships cooperated. They came to the U.S. They offloaded the cargo somewhere here, usually in Houston. And the cargo would then get sold, and the proceeds would be subject to a seizure order and go into a victims fund for victims of state-sponsored terrorism, right? One of these ships would have cargo valued anywhere between $50 million and $200 million. Again, huge numbers. But in 2022, the easy-peasy way of prosecuting or enforcement stopped rolling, much to the DOJ and much to the Treasury Department's surprise. There was a ship, a tanker, Suezmax, one of the big ones, called the Suez Rajan. And one of the non-governmental groups, United Against Nuclear Iran, had some satellite imagery. And they ran a story back which said, hey, we saw the Suez Rajan do a ship-to-ship transfer in the South China Sea, outside of Singapore. And the ship that loaded its cargo, or at least some of its cargo, onto the Suez Rajan was tracked back through satellite imagery to the Kerguelen terminal, right? Everybody knows about that now. It's been in the news big time. And they said, wait a minute, you've loaded this terrible contraband cargo of crude. Wait a minute. No one's snorting the crude. How is this a contraband? But that's how it was designated. And the owner was a foreign entity, foreign individual, with a foreign flagship, with all foreign nationals operating the vessel. And the question was, who are you to tell me what to do? Now just stop for a second. Think about something slightly differently. I know many people in our audience here today have had posts with the government, quite senior posts, and probably lived abroad. And I'm sure all of us have friends that were born and bred and raised abroad and raised their families abroad. Think about this. What if you're an Emirati kid? You grow up in the Emirates. Your parents are lucky enough to send you for a good education. You come back home and you start a shipping company. And you decide that you want to trade Iranian oil. What's your connection to the United States? What gives the U.S. the right to prosecute you for doing a lawful business? I don't know. Very strange, right? But the owners and the operators of the Suez Rajan held firm for over a year, and the ship bobbed around in the South China Sea. And ultimately, they had a Hobson's choice, and that was either dance with the Americans and turn over the oil, or dance with the Iranians and then have trouble with the Americans. So they chose to dance with the Americans, and they agreed to plead guilty. They did. They agreed to pay a fine, but the terms were quite complicated that they actually didn't pay a penny. It was a dollar-for-dollar offset
for bringing the ship from Singapore to Houston to offload it. And then ultimately, the cargo was offloaded and sold for $83.4 million to an unnamed buyer, with the funds being directed to the victims' fund. Ambassador Mark Wallace, the head of the United Against Nuclear Group, went down to Houston, took a victory lap, and was very proud to publish a picture of himself on top of the ship. But the Iranians said, hold on here, fellas. We can play that game too. A couple weeks later, they grabbed a tanker called the Advantage Suite, believed to be carrying Chevron cargo. And ultimately, they held up the ship and brought it into Iranian waters, and then they confiscated and sold the oil on board that vessel for approximately $50 million. And they too took the proceeds and put it to a victims fund, or at least what they identified as a victims fund. But the Suez Rajan, once the contraband cargo was off and the Americans got their money and off with all of the enforcement activity was concluded, what to do? What to do for the ship owner? The ship wasn't seized, just the cargo. So the owner gave it a paint job, changed its name from Suez Rajan to the St. Nicholas, and put it back in service. A couple weeks later, the newly named St. Nicholas goes to the Persian Gulf. The Iranian Coast Guard, Islamic Revolutionary Guard, comes on board, storms the ship, and steals it. The ship's still in Iran. Now, it wasn't just the St. Nicholas. The Iranians grabbed the St. Nicholas, the Advantage Suite, the Purity, the Niobe, and the MSC Ares. Right? This is a tit-for-tat game that's been going on for years now. But of course, the American, the mainstream media or the news cycle here doesn't pick up these stories. Why? It's complicated. It's not that interesting, really. So what about, if it's a tennis match, that was the Iranians' shot, what's the Americans' next shot? Well, we saw most recently the U.S. Coast Guard boarding foreign flag ships, not in U.S. waters, not at a U.S. port, but on the high seas. The Skipper in the Caribbean Sea, the Centuries in Venezuela, the Marinara, formerly known as the Bella One, somewhere in the North Atlantic after a chase from the Caribbean all the way up to the North Atlantic. The Sophia, the Olina, the Veronica, the Sagita, the Aquila II, the Veronica III, and the Bertha. How are we doing this? What is the basis for the U.S. Coast Guard to board ships on the high seas that are not American flagged? Well, it's quite simple. We know in the case of the Skipper, that was a ship that wrongly declared it was flying the flag of Guyana. And because it was a false declaration, the ship was then deemed to be stateless. And a stateless ship doesn't have the protection of its flag administration, the sovereign authority, which is supposed to be the oversight arm while in international waters or on the high seas. So as a result of that, there are some U.S. Laws and regulations that allow for what they call a right of visit, and the Coast Guard went on board, and it's not unlike a police stop, right? They ask some questions, they go on board, and if something seems off, then they escalate the visit, and that's exactly what happened. But the Centuries wasn't a stateless vessel. It was a Panamanian flag vessel. So what to do? Well, that's an easy one. They rely on us for a lot. So we called them up and said, can we go on board? And the Panamanian said, yeah, no problem. Let us know how it goes. And that's what happened. So subsequent to that, these vessels get boarded, and it's not the ships themselves that get confiscated, but rather the cargo. That's the high value. In fact, taking the ship itself would be a real pain in the neck, right? Because these are deteriorating assets every single day. And so how do they do it? Well, they come back in here, and I have a screen grab for you of the application for a warrant to seize property. And this is with the MT Skipper, the motor tanker Skipper. And they filed, the Department of Justice filed it in U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. And the magistrate judge in fact, went ahead and issued a warrant to seize the property subject to forfeiture. That's how the U.S. is now boarding and confiscating vessels and ships on the high seas. With that, I'll leave you with a very shameless photo, a subliminal advertisement of a younger, slimmer me. And I guess, George, we'll take a few questions.
While we're collecting questions from the audience, I always take the advantage that you get as a moderator to ask the first question. Recently, and I'm thinking in terms of our blockade of oil shipments to Cuba. Would you say a few words about the legal authorities to issue these type of, or perform these type of efforts? I mean, does it relate to any of the type of stuff that you've been talking about?
Yeah, actually, in the last several weeks, let me give a little background if you don't mind. There has been a blockade of oil and petroleum products into Cuba. Basically, it's blacked out, right? And in the past several weeks, we've had at least half a dozen, maybe 10 foreign clients that have opportunities to do business into Cuba, bring their ships or bring cargoes, what have you. And the question is, can we do it? And the answer is, there's actually no legal prohibition on doing it. It's a practical prohibition. Do they want to risk getting designated on the SDN list? Do they want to risk running afoul of the U.S. Coast Guard, who's there enforcing it? Do they want to get crosswise with the U.S. government? And I think 6 out of 6 or 10 out of 10 or whatever the number of clients that we had all said, no thanks, we'll find some other business, and have basically succumbed to the pressure. So as far as the legal rationale for it, there's executive orders, there's some other things that the government relies on as a legal basis, but the reality is there's no legal fights, there's no testing of it in a court. It is all commercial and pragmatic, as of now.
It is interesting the amount of influence the U.S. has through all sorts of both diplomatic and financial tools.
In fact, George, there was at least 6, possibly more than that, ships that came in voluntarily, turned over the cargo in the U.S. Gulf, long before the Suez Rajan ever got tangled up with the U.S. government. And it was the very same commercial pressure, and really it was the boogeyman they were afraid of, because what could happen? And the answer always was, it could be really bad. Well, how bad? Really bad. Well, what does that mean? I don't know. I don't want to find out.
There's someone asked a question that I find particularly interesting. If the U.S. sanctions shipping by one country, doesn't the country that would be receiving the shipment have a claim against the U.S.?
Well, no, because there's a thing called sovereign immunity, right? And it's not necessarily countries that are sanctioned. We saw in Venezuela that there was an OFAC issue where U.S. entities were not permitted to trade in and out of Venezuela, or else risk be designated on the special designated national list. Now, that's only for some companies. We know in January that there was a number of these vessels carrying Venezuela crude, largely destined to other places like China or Russia or anywhere else it might go. The conventional wisdom amongst the enforcement community was that the money would go back to Iran or other terrorist groups that shouldn't have been receiving it. And so the U.S. took these enforcement actions with the ships we saw on the slide and basically had a problem on their hands. Again, not so much legal, but more pragmatic. So what do you do with all this oil? What do you do with it? It was a tremendous amount. It was billions of dollars worth of oil. And so a decision was made after a meeting at the White House on one Friday in January that the Office of Foreign Assets Control and the Department of Treasury was going to license two traders, two worldwide traders, Trafigura and VTOL, and it was under that license that they were permitted to buy the oil and then resell it. Of course, when they resold it, it had to be legitimate business to non-sanctioned entities. And that's what they did with that oil that was then on what was termed the dark fleet vessels. Now, what happens to the vessels? That's still an open question. Some of them are around, some of them were let go, some of them will probably be the subject of future litigation. It's all evolving at the moment, and it's in the very early stages.
Someone notes that you talked about the agreement we had with Panama that permitted us to board their ships. Do we have similar agreements with other countries?
Well, nothing official that I know of, but when you add Liberia, Marshall Islands, and Panama, that's pretty much almost all the world's ships. So that covers everything from a functional perspective. It functionally covers all the ships we need to be worried about.
And then someone has a comment on seizing cargo on the high seas. It says it sounds like piracy. How come this doesn't start a fight with other nations when we do this?
Well, it's funny you say that. There's a Lloyd's List article with a photograph of a guy that looks like me who called the Coast Guard pirates. It's true. It does sound a lot like piracy, and perhaps it might be. I mean, let's change the facts for a little bit. What about the Iranians? When they grabbed the Advantage Suite, were they acting as pirates or were they acting as global enforcers? Changed the name of the actor. Now it's not the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, it's the US Coast Guard. Are we more right than they are? I don't know. I suppose that depends on a lot of factors, right? Perhaps your political leanings, I don't know. But the worst part, though, George, is I'll go one step further. And we're moving away from the sanctions and going back to the enforcement of the MARPOL treaty. The treaty itself is not self-executing. So what that means is for the lawyers is, okay, everybody signs it, but you're now obliged to go back to your domestic legislatures and create domestic legislation to implement it. And we did that. Of course, the Americans don't want to be one of the herd. We have to create our own version. And our version is called the Act to Prevent Pollution from Ships. So remember what we're talking about. Is this piracy? Foreign flag ship, foreign crew with a foreign bad act, alleged foreign bad act, happens and it stumbles into the United States, comes to a U.S. port. How does the Coast Guard and the Department of Justice prosecute that? We know ships are here today, gone tomorrow. Time's money, right? If they're not moving, not carrying cargo, they're not making money. In fact, it's a deteriorating asset and an expensive one at that. So how do they prosecute? We know, again, by treaty obligations, that no port state is supposed to interfere with international shipping, and no port state's allowed to make shipping unduly expensive, right, or burdensome. So what do they do? The Coast Guard calls their friends at Customs and Border Protection. They get what's known as a public benefit parole exception, and they take the crew off. They say, come on, guys, pack up your stuff. We'll pay you, and we'll pay you all your overtime. You go to a great motel just down the block. And sometimes the crew comes off willingly, sometimes they don't. But they're now detained in the U.S., the jurisdiction of the court where the ship came in for an indefinite period of time. They want to leave, can't do it. Elderly parents passing away, can't go to the funeral. Kids getting married, can't go, they're detained. For an unlimited amount of time. Does that sound right? Does that sound like something we should be doing? I don't know about that. A month, maybe 2 months, okay. But what happens when it's 15, 18 months, 2 years? It's a lot of time. They miss your life, right? And getting paid your salary doesn't seem to make up for the lost time. But this is how the Coast Guard prosecutes these suspected violations. Now, we did a study, a comparative analysis, and this was going back to the days when the Somali pirates were hot and heavy in East Africa. And at the time, we had statistics from the KNR, the Kidnap and Ransom Insurers. And the average length of the detention of a vessel and her crew by the Somali pirates was like 9 to 12 months. At the time, the average length of a foreign flag vessel's crew being detained in the U.S. while one of these cases wound its way through the system was between 9 and 12 months. The average amount of bounty paid to the pirates was between $1 and $3 million, depending on the ship and the cargo. The average settlement with a criminal fine for a MARPOL violation was between $1 and $3 million. In the same period of time, the Somali pirates collected like $85 million. The U.S. Coast Guard, like $125 million. So in that same article where I called them pirates, I said, they're worse than the pirates, but they have better uniforms.
A couple of questions here related to kind of the more general questions. One is, can insurance claims be denied if the record books are found to be falsified?
Yeah, that voids coverage. Now, there's an asterisk in this story. There is no coverage for what's viewed as intentional misconduct, which to me doesn't make a huge amount of sense, and it's a fight I continue to battle. If a ship owner had a crew member that was mad for some reason, disgruntled, the food was terrible, who knows, right? And goes down in the engine room and opens up a valve and dumps oil into the water, that's called barratry of the crew, and that's covered. 100 cents on the dollar. If you have a disgruntled crew member, or worse yet, a lazy crew member who doesn't want to use the pollution prevention devices because it's a pain in the neck, right? The equipment's not all that reliable. It's gotten a lot better in the years, but it's still hard work. And they take a shortcut. And that's against the teachings of the owners and the managers of the vessel. And it's against all the time and money that they spent making sure the crew were properly trained and had the tools to do their job professionally and lawfully. That is not covered because it's viewed as an intentional misconduct.
And here's what I'm talking about, the inherent risk in shipping, because we all know, you know. How much has the problem been increased by what's happening in the Middle East?
Well, it depends on your perspective, right? It's all about that. If you were a seafarer and you get offered the opportunity to sail on a vessel that's going to make one of those voyages, you'll get a hefty sum of money for it. If you need the money, maybe you'll take the risk. We know that there's a tremendous number of companies that are sending ships through. And just this morning, a Costco container ship went right through the Strait of Hormuz, no problem. We know other companies are sending their ships through, and some of these tankers that before the war, the market rate was about $50,000 a day. To make that run, $500,000 a day. They'll be billionaires for the individuals and the companies that have the guts to do it.
But at a risk.
Yeah.
You've talked a lot about the U.S. enforcement. Is there no international law or U.N. authority that applies to these situations?
Well, there is. There's a United Nations Convention on the Law of the Seas. UNCLOS is the acronym. But it's fairly toothless, and it really delegates both the flag state for things that occur on the high seas, and then thereafter to the port state when the ships come in.
And the U.S. hasn't ratified that treaty.
No.
So we're not a party. And then what's the role of the International Maritime Organization in all of this?
Well, again, it's all the same, I would say, from my perspective, gripe from the world of people that are trying to make a living as ship owners and operators. IMO is an important group, and it is well-intended in many respects, but it doesn't have the impact that you would expect it to have. Now, they have working committees and subcommittees to the subcommittees on particular issues, and they make recommendations and identify things like best practices, but they're not an enforcement arm. Right, that's where the problem comes in. So I wouldn't say it's a toothless operation, but it is very much dependent on flag and port states enforcement.
And then we've been talking about the U.S. in doing this enforcement. Are there any other countries helping out on this that doing similar things?
Like the French? That's a joke, George. yes, there are, but not to the same extent, right? So we know certain port states take interest in certain misconduct on the high seas, but it's generally limited to domestic enforcement of issues that occur much closer to home. We are, I would say, out on a limb with what we do. There are, of course, coalition activities, but we are, on one hand, we're industry leaders, and on one hand, we might be out on a limb. I'm not sure.
And then your video told us that we're presenting only the tip of the iceberg. Why don't the sanctions work better? Why are we doing only the tip of the iceberg?
Yeah, so that video was in with respect to the MARPOL violations. And that the prosecutor who made that video, and it's still available on YouTube and other places, was talking about, you know, a very well-intended program to rid the world of substandard ships and substandard operators, right? I mean, just think about this from the perspective of, you know, who wants someone to pollute the ocean? Like, nobody does, right? It doesn't matter where you're from or what your background is, your ethnicity or your religious beliefs. Nobody wants to swim in an ocean that's got oil in it. So that's an easy one. With the sanctioned stuff, it's not so clear because there's not the same hook, right? There's not the same feeling of venom towards what's going on. Because what are we doing? We're going to black out Cuba? Who are we going to black out next, right? Like, there's a lot of people that don't agree with this as an enforcement tool, and we don't have the federal court or legal precedent that says, yeah, this is okay yet.
So what happens if the U.S. military stops guaranteeing the safety and security for international shipping? Are we going to have a free-for-all?
Well, I don't think they guarantee anything yet. And I know that the presence is supposed to be a deterrent. But I know the ships that have gone through the Strait of Hormuz in the last few weeks have zero guarantees, and that's why the price is 10 times the amount it was beforehand. That's a commercial marketplace adjustment, not a governmental guarantee adjustment.
And here's one of those cases where I know nothing about this topic, so I'm going to read a question, but I don't know what it means. Well, what do you think of the Jones Act?
Oh, that's a super hot potato. So the Jones Act is actually well-intended. Just to give a little background on the Jones Act, it's called in legal circles a cabotage law, which says that if you can't trade between two U.S. ports and be a foreign flag vessel. Now, you can come in and unload cargo, let's say, in Houston, and then go to New Orleans and pick up a cargo and leave. But you can't come into Houston and give a little bit there, and then pick up and then carry it over to New Orleans and drop it off over there. You can't do it. You have to be American flag to do that sort of trade. So it was a protectionism statute as it was intended. But we found out during Deepwater Horizon, we don't have American ships. Who's going to go clean up? Who's going to go do the work out there? So there was a Jones Act waiver so foreign flag vessels could come in. Now, a parenthesis, you would have thought we learned our lesson, right? And then we have a great movement where we're going to have wind power, renewable energy, and we're building wind farms all over the place, down in Martha's Vineyard, down off in New Jersey. Who's going to do the work? We don't have enough American vessels to do it. So there's another waiver. And now we're seeing that there's a waiver yet again to stimulate commerce and be able to get ships in, get ships moving, and what have you. But the question now becomes, and this is, again, slash commercial slash legal, there is a tax. And it's a gross ton, it's a gross freight tax of up to 4% earned. With a foreign flag vessel, ordinarily they don't pay the tax because there's a multilateral tax treaty in place with wherever they're home ported. But if you have a foreign flag vessel coming into the U.S. that's now trading you know, what would otherwise be prohibited under the Jones Act. Are they subject to U.S. taxation? I think the answer is yes, but I don't know. We'll have to see. Probably should be. If an American flag vessel, an American company was doing that same trade, they pay taxes. Why shouldn't the foreign companies do it? Seems fair to me.
So how many American flagged, ships are there that, you know, international trade?
Not many. We have some, and there are a few owners and operators, but I would say the vast majority of U.S. flag vessels fall in the tug and barge space, right? They're doing coastwide trade, maybe Jacksonville to Puerto Rico, and there are some American flag ships, but generally speaking, they are quite old and about to come to the end of their useful life. Not all of them, but a good number of them. I mean, we saw that a few years ago. If you Google the word El Faro, it was a ship that had been retrofitted and it was on a run and got stuck in a hurricane and sank. And that was on the run, I believe, from Jacksonville to Puerto Rico.
So we talked about the law of the sea and the fact that, it's toothless, but B, why hasn't the U.S. signed a treaty like the law of the sea? What dangers do we see in signing it and ratifying it?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly. I think the Americans like, as a general proposition, like to put our own spin on a few things. I'm much more familiar with the MARPOL Treaty in the sense that the U.S. is the only signatory when they enacted the domestic legislation. Instead of adopting the treaty word for word, they adopted a whistleblower provision. And it sounds pretty good, right? It says that anybody giving information that leads to the payment of a criminal fine or a civil penalty is able to get a reward up to half the amount. Sounds good, right? But how do you define whistleblower? That's the question, and that's where this is a great subject for debate. In my mind, or always goes to, when I'm talking whistleblowers, Julia Roberts. Oh, I love her. But I go to the movie when there was the big plant, the big chemical plant in town, and everybody in town worked there, and the people wanted to do the right thing, but the bad guys, the big corporations, were taking shortcuts because they were profit-driven, right? That was a whistleblower. And anyone that stood up for the right thing was at great risk to themselves and their families, their jobs, their livelihoods. And in the movie, maybe it was a sensational story, but maybe it was based on true facts. People's homes were getting firebombed and things like that. But in the maritime space, it's not quite so dramatic. The whistleblowers can be the guys that were dumping at sea for weeks and months. And then the ship fortuitously stumbles into the U.S. and they go, oh, you're not going to believe what we were doing out there. Really? Who was doing it? I did it a couple times. Why? I don't know. It felt nice. All right. Let's tell me more about this. Was the oil record book accurate? No. Does everyone know about that? Yeah. All right. Here's $2 million. Thank you for telling us. It's a little perverted, but again, it's an important law enforcement tool, no doubt.
Here's another act. I do remember the Jones Act now, because yeah. I remember hearing about it on the radio, but didn't strike me when I first saw it. What enforcement do you anticipate seeing coming from the Safer Seas Act?
Well, I'm not sure. I'll tell you why I'm not sure. Shortly after...
First of all, tell us what it is.
Well, it's the same thing, right? It's all intended to root out substandard shipping, right? It's okay. Supposed to keep our ocean safe. It's supposed to keep our crews safe. It's supposed to, it's really a health and safety type of perspective, right? We thought where MARPOL was a great enforcement tool for the U.S. for pollution anywhere in the world, and there was tremendous amount of enforcement, like $1 billion or more worth of criminal fines paid to date, maybe more than that now. Shortly thereafter, there were regulations that were intended to curb noxious fumes, SOX and NOx, right? And we thought, oh, well, this will be the next great MARPOL case. And we've seen none of those prosecutions. More recently, we saw, in the same vein, what's called the Vessel General Permit Obligation, a VGP obligation, and that's any ship that comes to the U.S. has to obtain this permit, and with the permitting, there's all sorts of regulations to how you document your waste streams, and not just like byproducts of your engine waste streams where it's oily waste, but also things like your ballast water and the microorganisms that you can bring into other people's waters and cause problems. And that's been delegated to the EPA. And while we saw under the last administration some interest in investigating VGP violations, we see zero interest with the current administration. And cases that were underway or in process under the last administration have gone cold, and I suppose it wouldn't come as a surprise to some that the government lawyers or agents that were handling those cases, many of them have left government service. So there's it's a real upheaval in that space.
I think we have time for one more question. I want to talk about drug boats. What should the U.S. be doing about the high seas transport of drugs? Are we doing, we know what we're doing in the Caribbean and the East Pacific, but.
Yeah, I think that's been a well-worn wheel for many years, right? And the Coast Guard exercises its authority. And again, to make an analogy that we'd all be familiar with, it's like a traffic stop. If you're a vessel and you're in the water and you're carrying on that seems something that's non-suspicious or ordinary, they'll leave you alone. If something seems off and the Coast Guard hails the boat, and if they get either false information or information that doesn't sound quite right, or oftentimes in the drug interdictment sector, these fast boats just hit the gas and off they go, right? So again, it's not unlike a traffic stop, right? If a car takes off on the highway, it might be a high-speed pursuit. It might get escalated to the cops putting out the tire busters on the road, maybe even taking more aggressive actions. Same thing on the high seas, right? The Coast Guard maybe gives chase and goes in pursuit. They can escalate it with a warning shot, and then theoretically they can escalate it with a shot to take out the engines. Of course, the news doesn't pick up those stories. They only pick up the ones where the boats get blown to smithereens, and I guess that happens. But the real issue, and I would say in Coast Guard circles, if there was Coast Guard or former Coast Guard folks here, what's become really a touchy subject is, now what do you do with the disabled boat? You're going to tow it back to Miami? They don't. So what if they leave it out there? Isn't that a hazard to navigation? Yeah, it is. What if you sink it? Well, that's what they do. But isn't that environmentally hazardous? Yeah, it is. Yeah, who's looking? Nobody. So that's what happens.
I thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.